Tolliver v. McCautry. Mr. Mullins.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Brian Mullins. I represent Stephen Tolliver, who is the petitioner and the appellant in this case. I would like to focus on the jury instruction issue because I think of the six issues that we raise, other than the right to an evidentiary hearing on appeal, I think other than that, all of the issues really go to the question that is raised in the jury instruction issue, which is, was there evidence that a jury could find that Mr. Tolliver did not intend to kill Ms. Rogers? And the right to a jury instruction, we believe, is a constitutional right guaranteed by due process. And I would invite the court to consider a case that we actually did not cite in the brief, but we would like to consider as supplemental authority, which is Tyson versus Trigg, a case from this circuit in 1995. And the court, in a habeas case, stated that we have already seen that a criminal defendant has a constitutional right to present witnesses in support of whatever defenses to the offense with which he is charged state law creates. The right would be empty if it did not entail the further right to an instruction that allowed the jury to consider the defense. I think the corollary to that is that a defendant has the right.
The Supreme Court has never declared such a right.
We are relying on two Supreme Court cases, which we do cite in the brief, and that would be the Matthews case from 1988 and the Crane case from 1986.
I thought the court had just required the lesser included instruction in capital cases.
The court does require it in capital cases. However, we're not necessarily relying on the right to a lesser included offense. I don't believe that that is a constitutional right, but there is a constitutional right to present a defense. And that is a right guaranteed by due process, which the Matthews court refers to. In that case, the defendant, it was held that the defendant was entitled to an entrapment instruction where there was evidence of entrapment, even though the defendant denied the elements of the offense.
Well, isn't the question, the question is, would not be whether the failure to instruct on the lesser offense was correct or not, but whether the failure created a complete miscarriage of justice.
Correct. That's what this court has held.
So,
yeah, but that's not good enough. You have to have Supreme Court authority right on point.
And we rely on Matthews and Crane.
I think your argument is a loser. I think you have a good argument. Why don't you say something about the Brady issue?
I think the Brady issue is also relevant, but I think all of these issues go to the question of intent to kill. The Brady issue was certainly, there was ample evidence that the prosecutor did not disclose this communication to counsel for Mr. Tolliver. Had that communication been disclosed, the entire question of intent to kill is also an issue. And we believe that all of these issues merit a writ of habeas corpus.
Well, the defendant's lawyer knew about this fellow Smith, is that right?
Correct.
So the defendant's lawyer knew about it.
He did not know about it. It came to light later, I believe.
No, I'm sorry, I'm wrong. But the Stephen Tolliver knew that Smith was
It came to light to Mr. Tolliver after his trial. He did not know of it. It came to light to Mr. Tolliver after his trial.
No. Tolliver knew that Smith was present when Rogers
actually
was shot.
Well, Smith was not present. This was a statement.
Oh, this was hearsay. This was
correct.
He overheard.
Correct. This was a statement that Smith claimed Thompson, who was present, made to him.
I see. So you're saying, that Stephen Tolliver didn't know
correct
about Smith until after.
And we believe that would have been admissible to impeach Mr. Thompson, and Mr. Thompson's credibility was crucial, given that he was one of the witnesses, one of the three witnesses to the crime, or one of the four witnesses to the crime. But the Matthews and Crane cases, we do believe, provide Supreme Court authority that if there is evidence, then I think the miscarriage of justice has occurred here, because Mr. Tolliver is serving a life sentence. We believe that there was ample evidence that he did not intend to kill Ms. Rogers, and if the jury was to believe Mr. Tolliver's testimony, then we believe that a reasonable jury could have found that he did not intend to kill Ms. Rogers. However, the jury was given only one choice, either convict on a first-degree intentional homicide or acquit. It was clear that Mr. Tolliver did something here that constituted a crime. The jury did not want to acquit Mr.
Yes,
Tolliver.
But you see, the issue is not whether he can make a defense. The issue is whether there's ever a duty to give a lesser-included instruction. And the Supreme Court has only ruled that there's such a duty in a capital case. It hasn't confronted the other cases.
But the Supreme Court has ruled that there is a duty to provide an instruction when there is evidence supporting that instruction.
It's like saying there's a duty to provide due process or something. If you read, you know, Supreme Court decisions broadly enough, you end up abolishing the distinction that the, you know, ADPA tries to make between Court of Appeals or state Supreme Court rulings and Supreme Court rulings.
And I understand we're talking about the broad concept of due process, but I think the Matthews case is sufficiently
similar. Yes, and that doesn't
similar.
Do it. That doesn't do it. You have to find a Supreme Court case on point. Supreme Court case that says, yeah, there's a duty.
If the court is correct, there is no Supreme Court case that has said a lesser included instruction is required in a non-capital case. That this court was responding to that, I believe, when it created the miscarriage of justice standard,
but
which we believe we have met.
You can't rely on a court of appeals decision.
But I believe the court of appeals, that was a post-AEDPA case, this court's decision creating the miscarriage of justice standard. I believe it was relying on the standards that were created in AEDPA. So I think this court was simply responding or applying Supreme Court law as it saw, which is the right to present a defense, which we have cited from Matthews and Crane.
It's hardly a right to present a defense to say you're guilty of some other crime.
Well, I think the right to present a defense is the right for, there's the compulsory.
Look, the way you're putting it, the right to present a defense encompasses every procedural right that any court has ever recognized.
I think all we are saying is that when a defendant provides evidence that is a reasonable jury could find in his favor on, a court is obligated to instruct the jury of that defense. Whether it's an affirmative
defense, for goodness sake.
I think whether it's an affirmative
defense. This is instructing the jury, you can convict this defendant of something else in addition. That is not a defense.
Well, in this case, his defense was that he did not intend to kill Ms. Rogers.
And that's certainly a defense.
And I think one of the
theories.
Jury
to say, oh, by the way, you may want to find that I committed another offense.
And
that's not a defense.
Well, I think one of the theories.
I understand what you're saying, but what to call it a right of defense is just using words in order to get around the rule that you have to have Supreme Court authority if you want to, you know, get your judgment set aside in a habeas corpus proceeding.
Again, I would refer the court to the Matthews decision. That was an entrapment instruction.
You're barking up the wrong tree. Entrapment is a defense. This is not a defense.
I think this is a defense.
You're
wasting
that. Your time on a losing argument when you have a good argument. Not necessarily a winner, but you have a good argument, which you haven't. You don't want to talk about.
Thank you. I will address the other issues that we have raised. I think all of the issues do go to the intent to kill Ms. Rogers, and therefore Mr. Tolliver was prejudiced by the court's errors on those issues. On the Brady issue, as we have discussed, this was alleged evidence that Mr. Tolliver was not made aware of. It was clearly a Brady issue or a Giglio issue.
If we were to decide that the letter would have made a difference.
Correct.
Would we have to remand for a determination as to whether the letter was actually received? Because, you know, the state court presumed that the prosecutor's office got.
I think that would have been an issue that could have been addressed on direct appeal at an evidentiary hearing. And that's our sixth issue, is that the Court of Appeals, once Mr. Tolliver had his habeas petition granted on the right to an appeal, the Court of Appeals did not allow an evidentiary hearing with counsel present. And our position is that the denial of an evidentiary hearing with counsel present was effectively denying his right to appeal.
You mean when he was there in his underwear?
Correct.
Yeah.
And I think that whether the prosecutor did in fact receive the letter is certainly an issue that an evidentiary hearing would probably be warranted on. But all of the issues, I think they all have to be considered in total. The ineffective assistance of counsel claim, that two witnesses were not called, these all are also directed at undercutting the testimony of the witnesses who were present, supporting Mr. Tolliver's testimony that he did not intend to kill Ms. Rogers, but that he was simply on the scene and brought her there and was responsible for bringing her there, but did not have the intent to kill Ms. Rogers before he brought her there. And his testimony that he expressed surprise and maybe outrage when his brother killed Ms. Rogers supports that defense. And I think all of the testimony that was not presented as a result of his counsel's failure to call these witnesses as a possible result of the district attorney's failure to turn over the statement to Mr. Tolliver, that all goes to those questions.
Of course, you know, both of those witnesses were relatives of the Tollivers with their own agendas. Defense counsel might have thought that their testimony would not only be unbelievable, but maybe damaging. So, I mean, you know.
Well, he didn't even interview these witnesses, which is also a separate ground to find counsel being ineffective. So the fact that he didn't interview the witnesses seems to suggest that he didn't take the strategic matter into consideration. He didn't really
go that step. Well, you can't blame him on not calling Smith, right?
No, we can't blame him for that. That we're blaming the district attorney on. But as far as the two witnesses, we believe those would have been crucial witnesses. Sure, the district attorney could have cross-examined them on their relation to Mr. Tolliver, but Oliver Tolliver was also a relative. All of these people were either relatives of each other or dating each other, so everybody had some kind of credibility issue. I'm into my rebuttal time, so I will reserve.
Mr. Gansner?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, William Gansner appearing on behalf of the respondent appellee in this case, State of Wisconsin, if I may. I believe the Court in its questions to my adversary.
I'm bothered about this Smith business, right? I mean, it's very unclear what exactly happened at the murder. So wouldn't Smith have been an important witness?
Excuse me, Arne, was it your statement that it was unclear what had happened at the murder?
Yeah.
Well, I think...
Stephen, Tolliver's role at the murder is unclear. Murder itself is clear.
Yeah. Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully suggest that as the district court concluded, but most importantly, of course, in this habeas action, as the State Court of Appeals concluded, the evidence in the case, which I think the court is very well aware of by virtue of the colloquy that I think the court just had with my adversary, on the question of whether or not a jury instruction on felony murder was involved.
That. I'm not asking you about that. No, I'm asking you about Smith.
Right, but what I'm responding to,
well,
Your Honor.
Just respond about Smith and not about felony murder.
Well, I think the point is that the evidence was not cloudy or foggy or in doubt.
Why was Smith? I don't understand you. I don't understand. So the Wisconsin court said Smith's testimony would have been cumulative. I don't understand that. Cumulative. Smith's testimony, whoever Smith is, would have been testimony supporting, you know, Stephen Tolliver's It says the jury heard multiple witnesses testifying to determine that Stephen's version was not believable. Fine. Smith's testimony would have been cumulative. I don't understand. This is the critical issue, is what Stephen Tolliver said. There are these different versions.
But
kill
all of
the bitch, or I done kill, or you done killed the bitch, or something. So why isn't Smith's testimony highly material?
Because the undisputed testimony of the persons who were present at the time of the shooting indicated that Stephen Tolliver had said, as Tolliver himself acknowledged, the defendant, Stephen Tolliver, acknowledged, that he had said to Thompson, the drug dealer for whom Mr. Tolliver was apparently a drug runner, you should shoot whoever you believe stole your money. There then followed a killing.
Thompson didn't shoot anybody.
No. What happened was, and as the Court of Appeals concluded, that didn't take Mr. Tolliver off the hook because he was
taking him. It's not a question of taking him off the hook. It's a question of, did he actually intend that Rogers be killed? Now, when he said, and he said this goofy thing about kill me if you think I did it or something. So he says this to Thompson, and Thompson doesn't do anything. And then Tolliver's brother ups and shoots her. Now, Smith's testimony would have suggested that Stephen Tolliver was surprised by what happened.
And Stephen Tolliver's own testimony at trial suggested that that was his view, because of the three versions of the exclamations that were made about...
Suggested that what was his view?
Well, Stephen Tolliver, you'll recall, Your Honor, three witnesses that were present...
Look, you said that was Tolliver's view. Now, what did you mean? What was his view?
He testified that he said on this matter that I think was of considerable importance, after a shot had been fired, he said, according to his testimony, that you shot the bitch to his brother, suggesting that it was his view, and this was the argument the defense presented at trial, that he was surprised that his brother had done that. The versions of the other witnesses to the event who referenced bitch was he said to his brother after one shot was fired, kill the bitch. He directed him to shoot.
Supported Tolliver, Stephen Tolliver's evidence. And so why wasn't Smith, why didn't the government notify the defense that this fellow Smith might have exculpatory evidence?
Well, first, as the Court of Appeals noted, Your Honor, it was the prosecutor's view that no such letter had been received. Now, and that's noted in footnote 10 of the State Court of Appeals decision in this case. But moreover, the court was of the view...
Well, what I'm reading is Smith's testimony would have been cumulative. That's the ground for excluding.
No, but I note as well that the Court of Appeals referenced the fact that the prosecutor, responding to the motion raising the claim of exculpatory evidence, had stated, the prosecutor who had prosecuted this case, stated that he had not received Smith's letter. So that at most, the Court of Appeals said, the matter could perhaps have been the subject of an evidentiary hearing.
Yeah,
but that's quite critical, isn't it?
And they presumed that the prosecutor received the letter.
But it's not critical in this sense. If, in fact, we assume that such a letter had been received, did the absence of the letter, within the meaning of all of the jurisprudence with respect to denial of the due process because of the failure to disclose exculpatory evidence, did this deprive the defendant of of true exculpatory evidence?
Well,
or
look,
was it merely cumulative?
That's precisely the question, yes.
Yeah, and he said, she said, trial. Is there really such a thing as cumulative evidence? Or is every person's testimony relevant for the tally on either side of the he said, she said debate? And here, the state court makes this presumption that the prosecutor received the letter. So is that a factual determination that we're stuck with? Shouldn't we be remanding for a factual determination as to whether or not the letter was actually received. I mean, you've got, you know, the DA saying it wasn't received, the court saying, well, we're going to presume it was received. I mean, it's rather a mess.
I think the Court of Appeals decision has to be read, Your Honor, as saying if such a letter was sent and if such a letter was received, its effect here, the non-disclosure of it to the defense, was not prejudicial because what was being said in the alleged letter was simply what Stephen Toliver himself had suggested in testimony that was deemed to be so unreasonable.
It's so absurd because what you're saying is if a defendant denies intentionally killing, then the fact that someone who is not a defendant gives evidence in support of him is cumulative, which is ridiculous.
I hope
you realize that is ridiculous.
Well, Your Honor, let me try to take it out of the realm of ridiculousness and expand the scope of what I think was before the State Court of Appeals. We're focusing on one aspect of what was allegedly one thing that was said in an alleged letter.
It's the heart of the case.
Well,
right.
The Court of Appeals concluded, as on two occasions, that the evidence in this case was overwhelming, that the defendant had intended to...
I don't see the overwhelming evidence at all. I see a great confusion as to what was going on, and particularly as to what Stephen Toliver said.
I think the real question is, had that letter come in, what would have been the difference in this case?
We'll never know if it doesn't come in somewhere.
Well, it is often the case, Your Honor, when appellate courts are called upon to decide what would have happened if an event had occurred, we're required to assess the potential or non-existent prejudice from the absence of the letter. As the court's questions to my adversary has already indicated, the question in this case really goes to, and as my adversary has pointed out, and emphasizing his view...
Well, these violations are serious, and you have the burden of showing harmlessness.
Well, and I believe it is demonstrated in this case, Your Honor, by the very analysis that the Court of Appeals went through in deciding that...
Well, maybe I'm looking at the wrong opinion, but I thought all it said about Smith was that his evidence was cumulative, but maybe I missed that. Maybe I missed something. Where did they talk about Smith?
Well, in the alleged letter... Yeah, at page 19 of the Court of Appeals decision, where they say that the evidence would have...
Page 19 in the...
Of the State Court of Appeals decision. That's Exhibit O to the state's answer.
The appendix. Where's in the appendix or the paragraph or something?
I don't have the appellant's appendix directly in front of me here, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I know that my adversary can give you that page number. But what the Court of Appeals said in its decision was... that the question was, under Brady, the materiality of the allegedly exculpatory evidence. And the court analyzed this, saying the evidence would have been material, and its non-disclosure, if it in fact had been received, would have constituted a ground for reversal only if there was a reasonable probability that had all the evidence been disclosed to the defense, the result of the proceeding would have been different. It is in that connection
that
the Court of Appeals said...
And then what did they say after that?
They said that it was cumulative. It would not have affected the outcome of the trial because it was cumulative to what Stephen Toliver himself had said.
You're just saying what you're saying.
Well, Your Honor, I think
that's what's so ridiculous. It could be cumulative, but it couldn't be cumulative because it repeated, because it corroborated the defendant's self-serving testimony.
That it tended to support a view of the evidence that the court, in the most detailed analysis of the key issue, as my adversary has viewed it, was that there was no reasonable basis for concluding that there was any basis for a felony murder instruction.
Where's this? That's a separate issue. Where's this detailed analysis?
I'm referring to the very detailed analysis that the court went through with respect to the jury instruction issue. The question of the materiality of the alleged exculpatory evidence, the alleged letter, goes only to what effect had it been turned over, it would have had. Now, my opponent is not suggesting it would have led the jury to acquit the defendant. His argument is that it would have supported, I think, I believe it's his argument, it would have supported his claim that there should have been a felony murder instruction given. And that's why the central issue, as my opponent has emphasized
but
it,
what I'm
was
looking
that,
at,
that view of the evidence that's
I'm
contained
looking,
in the court's felony murder
at,
instruction
what I'm looking
decision.
At, this is the one in 248 Wisconsin 2nd 520. Is that was September 18th, 2001? Is that the opinion?
Yes.
They have a detailed discussion of the felony murder instruction issue, but it's a discussion of the law,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
Where's the discussion of what all the witnesses said?
Well, I believe that that was included within the court's description early in the case of its review of the testimony of the witnesses that had testified, those who were actually present and testified about the events that preceded the shooting, which was that Stephen Tolliver and his brother were tasked to find Miss Rogers, bring her back, that it was Mr. Tolliver, by his own admission, who said, it was the defendant, Mr. Tolliver, by his own admission, who said to Thompson, you ought to shoot whoever it is you believed stole your money. The clear inference being that they knew it was Tina Rogers because it was Mr. Tolliver, the testimony showed, who told Mr. Thompson that Tina Rogers had taken the money. So he was clearly then stating it was his intent that Tina Rogers should be killed. What then happened was when Mr. Tolliver put his shotgun down that he had been armed with when he went out and brought Tina Rogers back to the house, what then happened was instead of Mr. Thompson killing Miss Rogers, his brother did. And the testimony of three of the witnesses was that after one shot was fired by the brother Oliver Tolliver, that Stephen Tolliver then said, kill the bitch, and another shot was fired.
So
and she
Joe,
died as a result of two fatal wounds.
That's Joetta Thompson. Who's the third?
The third was Mr. Robinson that was present.
Robinson.
Damian Robinson.
But then you have Smith on the other side of the equation.
Yes, and it was in the alleged exculpatory evidence.
Well, you have Angel Tolliver.
But neither Stephen Tolliver's nor Mr. Smith's review of the events at all altered the fact that what had occurred prior to the moment of the shooting was that the two Tolliver brothers had gone out to get Miss Rogers to bring her back after Stephen Tolliver had reported that drug money had been belonging to Thompson had been stolen, and that it was Stephen Tolliver who said to Thompson, when the question arose, what should we now do with her, is that Stephen Tolliver demonstrated by his statement, the person you believe stole your money should be shot, thus indicating, we think very clearly, and that's what the Court of Appeals concluded, that that was unequivocal evidence of his intent that Tina Rogers be killed. What happened in this case was his brother Oliver did the shooting instead of Mr. Thompson.
Did Thompson testify?
Did Thompson testify? Yes, I believe he did. Yes, yes. Okay. It was Mr. Thompson. Sure. It was Mr. Thompson who said that after the first shot after Oliver Tolliver shot Rogers, he testified, Oliver Tolliver shot Miss Rogers, and then the defendant said, kill that bitch, kill her. Yes, Mr. Thompson did testify.
Strange. He's shot. She's been shot in the head. What more killing is there to be done?
Well, Your Honor, I'm no expert on fatal ballistics, but it is not outside the realm of possibility that a person could be shot once in the head and the wound not be fatal, but a second shot have finished her off. And in fact, we know that there were two shots fired.
Where did the first shot hit her in the head?
Your Honor, I don't recall exactly the forensics on this, but I think the testimony was that she died as a result of two shots. Now, one followed apparently quite briefly after the first, and it is entirely conceivable, and not outside the realm of experience, that a person survives for a period of time after one shot, and then a second shot is given.
Okay,
and that is apparently what happened here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Gansner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Mullins, do you have anything further?
Just going back to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision, which is at page 49 of our separate appendix, the court, its analysis was basically limited to Smith's testimony could not have altered the jury's view of Stevens' involvement in the homicide for the reasons we expressed in rejecting Stevens' argument for the felony murder instruction. The mistake the Wisconsin Court of Appeals made is looking at Mr. Tolliver's statement overly literally and not taking into context the way in which it was made, the possibility that Mr. Tolliver intended the statement, shoot whoever took the money. If you think I took the money, shoot me. I think it's fair to say that that was not intended literally, that that was intended as irony or bluffing, and Mr. Tolliver testified to that effect. He testified that when he was asked, did you intend for Mr. Thompson to kill you? He said no, even though he made that statement. That was evidence supporting his theory that he did not intend to kill Ms. Rogers. The statement that Mr. Smith provided, or that Mr. Smith said Mr. Thompson gave, would have been a contradictory of Mr. Thompson's testimony. Specifically, he said that Mr. Thompson said that Mr. Tolliver said that you shot the bitch after Oliver Tolliver shot Ms. Rogers. This would have been directly contradictory of Thompson's testimony that he said, shoot the bitch. And that's a crucial issue. That was the crucial issue in the case, I would submit. And therefore, the Brady violation is not harmless, and the case must be reversed.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And Mr. Mullins, you were asked to represent Mr. Tolliver.
Right.
Well, we thank you for your efforts on his behalf.